Welcome to the Armchair Directors, where each episode we take a look at one of cinema's great directors and their essential film. This week on the show, we are doing something a little bit different. I'm not going to be the one doing the hosting. Today, we have Professor Mary Dutter on the show, and she's going to host the show, and she's going to ask me some questions about one of my favorite baseball films, get you in a mood for opening week. It's 8 Men Out, directed by John Sayles. So, Professor Dutter, welcome back to the show. And
very good to be back. But and when you first approached me with this idea that we were going to try to do something baseball theme around the same time that, you know, the season was starting, and mm-hmm. I thought, oh, that's great. Okay, what do you want to do? And I'm thinking, okay, there's so many pinnacle baseball movies out there. You know, you've got, the
Field of Dreams.
Field of Dreams. Bull Durham. Oh, I have plenty of things to say about The Natural. And, you know, and I'm like, what do you want to do? And you're like, 8 Men Out. And I'm like, well, that's a way to really kind of punch baseball in the eye. Nothing like celebrating baseball with one of the biggest scandals that ever happened to the game. So I'm very interested in hearing about why 8 Men Out appeals to you so much.
Well, I think as a kid, I forgot what it was, like some kid's book. Okay. And it was like this kid. It's like a series where this was like when I was like 10, but the kid like can transport back in time and meet a baseball player by just touching a baseball card.
Oh.
And so he touches Shoeless Joe's baseball card and he meets him in 1919, and he's trying to warn him about, you know, hey, they're going to try to fix the series. Mm. Say no, or this is going to happen. And in the end, Joe kind of says, well, I wasn't going to do it anyway. I'm not going to do it. He goes back. At the end, everything still happens the same. He's still blamed. Mm-hmm. So, but that's kind of what got me interested in the scandal. In that book, they mention 8 Men Out, the movie.
Okay.
So I watched it, and I just really liked it. I mean, I'm a huge baseball fan, and anything. I have tons of, like, baseball history books, and mm-hmm. I could probably talk a little bit about that later.
Have you read Moneyball?
I've seen the movie, but I haven't read it.
Oh, okay.
But, this really appealed to me, and just kind of, I think it's just any sports. Like, imagine just that now, if it's found out that the Cleveland Indians took money to throw the World Series last year against the Cubs, that would be like the biggest sporting event, like news event. Like, it would be on CNN and Fox News and everything. They would forget everything about politics or anything. That would be the main story. Right. I just think, like, how, you know, thinking now, like, how could they do something like that? Well, reading a lot about the situation, gamblers and baseball were huge back then.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the cliche of the boxer throwing the fight, it was like that in baseball.
Yeah.
It wasn't just this, like, it was a problem. Even they kind of mentioned this, like, well, every year in the World Series, you hear something.
Right.
And that's just how common it was, that there were a lot of guys who would, you know, intentionally strike out or maybe catch drop a ball that they should have caught just so they can, you know, play out the odds and make some money with gamblers.
Because they weren't making money as players.
No, and that's kind of getting into what I really like about the accuracy in this movie, because they bring it up a bit how Charlie Kaminsky was such a cheapskate in real life. The scene, you know, at the beginning of the movie when they come back after they've clinched the World Series and they get a bunch of champagne. It's like, oh, that's nice of them.
That's flat.
Yeah, and it's like, well, what about the bonus he's mentioned? It's like, oh, these are your bonus. And it's fat champion. That happened.
Yeah.
And they briefly mention it how the aging pitcher, how he gets in on it, is because he was going to be promised a bonus if he wins 30 games, which...
That scene is hard.
Put that into perspective. Today, it's considered a really good year for a pitcher if he wins 20. There hasn't been Denny McClain for the Detroit Tigers, last player to do that, and that was in 1968. So we're talking about nearly 50 years since a 30-game winner has happened.
Right.
And so basically, I'll point this issue. Eddie Seacott, who was having a great year that year, he was promised a bonus if he won 30 games. And he gets to 29, and it's like they mentioned it briefly.
Yeah.
The owner benched him for like 3 straight weeks just so he couldn't get that bonus. And he says, well, I was, you know, trying to rest your arm for the World Series and everything.
Right.
And it was really like, I knew you were going to win it, so I did this so I can save a couple of bucks.
Yeah. I mean, but what is also kind of interesting is, because I read up on the White Sox, was that even though they portray Kaminsky as being this like complete tightwad, they actually had the highest pay of any of the other teams that were functioning at that time in 1919. So that gives you like a really good perspective of what you were saying earlier about people being very, very quick to want to throw any of these games mm-hmm. because if that was the situation at the best paid team, imagine what was going on in these other teams. Mm-hmm. And they had these clauses in their contracts. I mean, if players today looked at the kinds of contracts that they were dealing with in 1919, you know, they would completely laugh because if you refused your contract from the team that was presenting it for you, the one that you were actually obligated to play for, mm-hmm. if you turned it down, then you could not play for any other team.
Yeah, the only way you could get out is if they traded you.
And, right, exactly.
And that's a good thing you touched on because this it's hard to imagine. Like every year you're reading about how some guy gets signed for 10 years, like $100 million at least, and that's somewhat considered minor. Like every year it's millions and millions of dollars.
Right.
Like these guys were making peanuts back then. And I think most of them would take like part-time jobs during the offseason just to be able to keep the money going.
Right.
But there was the reserve clause.
Yeah,
reserve clause. And so things such as free agency or anything like that didn't happen. The only way you could leave the team you're on is if you got traded. Basically, the owners controlled you.
Which kind of actually reminds me of Hollywood contracts during that time.
Yeah, just like the studio system back
yeah,
in the day. Yeah,
right. So there's a kind of nice parallel there, which really is interesting when you consider the fact that John Sayles is the director, and he's one of the few directors that has had almost his majority of his career mm-hmm. working outside the studio system because he did not want to be hemmed mm-hmm. in that way. So it makes kind of perfect sense that Sayles is the one that's directing this film.
Yeah, and actually touching back what you said about why I would choose this and not something more popular like Field of Dreams, Natural, et cetera, et cetera. Like this one it's more independent, I think, because it's John Sayles and he's an indie guy. And it's not a movie that's very well known. I think, mm-hmm. you know, people would say Bull Durham or Field of Dreams, Natural, so on and so on before baseball movies before they get to this. And this is definitely one of the reasons why I enjoy it so much.
Yeah. And another thing, too, was that it took a really long time to get this made. I mean, it took 11 years for them, to the point of where John Sayles originally had like a whole cast figured out, and mm-hmm. because of how long it took to make this movie, people aged out of those roles, and he had to end up giving those roles to other people. Not to say anything against this cast, because this cast mm-hmm. is amazing for an independent film. This
it's
cast
amazing.
Is amazing.
Yeah, and I watched the video. MLB Network aired this like 3-4 years ago on their debut because MLB Network is still a pretty young channel.
Hmm.
And they had Bob Costas on and he was interviewing John Sayles and John Cusack.
Oh, cool.
And he was talking about how, he tried to pitch this movie around forever. And he said, people were saying, look, a lot of people have wanted to do this, but this thing is a curse. Nobody wants to make it. It's not a baseball movie. He said it took him a long time. And he actually said, like, originally, I wanted Martin Sheen playing third base, playing Buck Weaver. Instead, I got Charlie Sheen playing in center field.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And the fact that he said Orion. When you think about like independent films of the 80s and 90s, you think Miramax and Orion. And Orion mm-hmm. turned him down twice to make this film.
Yeah. And then, Orion was pretty big in the 80s because I know they did this. Mm-hmm. I think they did RoboCop, if I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. And then they did maybe Amadeus.
I think Amadeus was somebody else because that was Milos Forman, and I think he was. I almost want to say Warner Brother, but that's probably not right. But yeah, I mean, as far as where you were going to get your independent funding, mm-hmm. Orion and Miramax were really good bets, and that he couldn't make it work at Orion for a very long time is really significant. Even though, you know, this is an important part of American history. I mean, when you look at 1919, you're dealing with post-World War I America.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Lefty Williams, the pitcher, one of the two pitchers that takes the dive in the film, he missed 1918 season because he was in World War I.
Yeah, and actually, one of the other, because, you know, in this movie you have Studs Terkel and John Sayles, who actually, if you look at the pictures of Ring Lardner.
He looks exactly like him.
Looks exactly like him.
Yeah.
And just a little fun fact, Ring Lardner's son was Ring Lardner Jr., one of the Hollywood 10 who was blacklisted.
Right.
But
and you know who else was blacklisted? was the author of this book, Eight Men Out.
Elliot Asenoff, right?
Yeah, he was blacklisted from screenwriting in the 1950s. And the fact that, and maybe they really actually did call Kominsky commie, but there's a lot of weird 1950s House Un-American Activities Committee that kind of filters through this movie a little bit for me.
Well, this was kind of around the same time like it was depicted in Reds, if I'm not wrong, right?
Yeah, yeah.
There was a communist scare at this time, right?
We were still dealing with the Cold War, because this comes out in 88 and the Berlin Wall falls in 87, so we were kind of starting to deal with the aftermath of that. But
no, I meant 1919.
Oh, 1919. Oh yeah, very much so. Because that's 1919 is the year that the Communist Party starts in the United States, and it's in relation to how poorly all these factory workers are being treated in these new industrial cities in the United States, where you know people are getting mangled by machinery, they have 16-hour days. So yeah, this is the founding of the Communist Party, and so that's where you start getting communist, you know, Red Scare, Red Threat. Mm-hmm. So if you've seen something like J. Edgar, this plays right into that time period as well.
Yeah, and then you talk about the parallels, like Kenesaw Mountain Landis, he was actually a guy, I think before this, they briefly mentioned it, but he helped kind of fight the Red Scare.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
Then, you know, you have the baseball team called the Reds, who I remember during the height of the Cold War, they were changed to the Red Stockings, so it wouldn't be a... But yeah, you have that. So, and yeah, the guy's name is Commie, but he's anything but a communist because he wants everything
himself.
He's
all about capitalism.
Yeah.
In the worst way.
Mm-hmm.
There was something else that you just said. Go ahead. I might have to come back to it when I come.
Okay.
To
so
cut that little part out.
No, when I was really curious to hear your opinion on this film because you're not a big sports fan, right?
No.
Okay.
No. Although I do really like baseball. I think, you know, when you can go out and watch a game and, you know, there's something very kind of timeless about it. Every other sport, you have very set time periods. This one, it's like it's over when they're done.
Yeah.
So spending a summer afternoon at a ballpark, I think, is fantastic. When I went over to Japan, I went to a couple of baseball games in Japan, which has kind of ruined me for watching baseball games in America because they are literally like spectator sports. Mm. Every stadium that I went to, there is a specific cheering section, and they have songs for each one of the players.
Wow.
So when each one of the players comes to bat, they have their own their own chant and stuff. It's absolutely amazing.
Yeah, there's this funny video. I think it was the opening pitch, and they are promoting one of the Grudge movies.
Oh yeah, yeah, I saw that.
Oh yeah, and then like they're all like she throws the ball, and everybody just dies on the field. That's just like you don't see that in America.
Yeah, I mean, but Japan takes it to the nth degree when it comes to their ball.
Yeah, but so you're not a huge sports fan.
Not a huge fan, but I really like this time period.
Yeah, so. And you kind of said it feels you kind of give it a decent review, but you said it feels a bit formulaic. So
is it
kind of just follows the sports movie formula that you see in a lot of movies?
No,
or?
Actually, it was more about just being a historical procedural and wanting to get things right. And what was interesting also that when I was researching this is the controversy, especially about Shoeless Joe Jackson. Did he? Didn't he? Mm-hmm. You know, well, what was his average during these games? Would that have actually helped the team? You know, did he look like he was throwing it? And also the character that John Cusack plays, Buck Weaver, and how was he in on it? Was he not in on it? And this whole kind of going back and forth. So there was an article, I guess, written in a Chicago Law review in 2009 that went over about completely debunking Eight Men Out, because I guess when Eight Men Out came out in 1963, the book, not the movie, everybody just took that as this is the story of what happened, because I guess there wasn't a lot of digging into it prior to that because most of the people in Chicago didn't want to believe that about you know their heroes, and it was just a black eye to everyone involved. This is where you start getting commissioner of baseball and how that starts to affect the game. I think Sales is really trying to be very careful about what he does in order to be as faithful to the book Eight Men Out, because in his mind and in most people's mind in 1988 and even the 11 years they were taking to make this, that was the story.
Yeah.
And that there was no other narrative associated with it. Mm-hmm. And I think Sales had so much respect. And it's very clear to see because of the way that the characters are treated. especially how Comiskey is so much the bad guy. It's so really easy for him to be this sort of maniacal character. You know, he's there's not a lot of ambivalence about that character.
Yeah, yeah.
That he just cared a lot and he wanted to see it done the way he felt right. So when you read the 2009 article from this this law review in Chicago and they start talking about, well, this and this and this, then you start to see another narrative form about the relative guilt and innocence of people, which kind of throws a little bit of this whole idea of Eight Men Out and the Black Sox into a very different light.
Yes.
So even though you have this very careful rendition of what happens in the book, now you have to start to approach it from a different sort of historical slant, which I think is really interesting.
Yeah.
And I hope more people do actually watch it, because if they're not familiar with the story and they want to also start to get into a little bit more about, well, what was happening in baseball in 1919? Like, I didn't know that this was one of the few games where they had a nine-game World Series versus a seven-game World Series.
It was trying to capitalize after World War I, kind of the patriotism of baseball, now to get back to normalcy, sort of.
Which is a perfect thing, and I wish they kind of maybe were bringing that out more in the movie, because they really don't spend any time on that, but here you have America's sport, you know, and really kind of capitalizing on that post-World War I patriotism, but it's rigged from the get-go. I think this could have been more nuanced and a little bit more interesting, because it's really kind of painted in a very black and white way, and I think more was going on.
Okay. Yeah, because one of the arguments people have that Jackson was a bit more involved than people would think is that, yes, he had one of the highest average of any player in that series. He hit the only home run that was in that series, and he did not commit any errors. They said, well, you know, all these numbers are so great, how could you say he possibly, like, took a dive? A lot of people noticed that a lot of those hits that he recorded were when the game was already out of hand, and it was sort of like he's getting this garbage time padding his stats, so to speak, to make it look better than he's actually doing.
Because when you had a couple of pitchers that were not willing to throw the games and a couple of people on the field that were willing to really want to win this, like you got, I love the way they portray the catcher in this.
Yeah, Ray Schalk.
Yeah, I thought that was really good. You know, it's very easy to see that even when you have like these essentially kind of seven, almost six guys in your back pocket, they can still win the game. I mean, these are all like critical positions on the field.
Yeah, and looking at the team, they talk about how they make a point of saying how great this team is. Like, this team's one of the greats. And knowing baseball history, like, that's pretty much true. Like, this team, I mean, most of the players were on this team won the World Series 2 years earlier in 17.
Yeah, 17, yeah.
And then, so, like, the catcher, Ray Schalk, he's a Hall of Famer. Eddie Collins, the guy that nobody likes, they always call him College Boy.
Yeah,
that man's
right.
A Hall of Famer.
Right.
And then even you look at the numbers, you could probably definitely make cases with like Shoeless Joe and then Eddie Seacott, and those guys would probably be Hall of Famers if this didn't happen.
Right.
So you do have this like one of the all-time great listed teams, and I think we could have like four or five Hall of Famers just on this one team alone.
Right.
And so it does, you know, emphasize how great this team was.
Yeah, when they're having the courtroom scene at the end, and they've got Kid Gleason on the on the stand, which I always love the scenes between John Cusack and John Mahoney in this, because it's just like, oh, let's say anything. But but when they ask him point blank, you know, is this the best team you or do you think they threw the game, or do you think they weren't doing what they were supposed to be doing? He just kind of flat out looks at the person and says, this is the best team I've ever seen together play baseball. And what he's saying is totally true, but you can see his eyes, like his heart
is
breaking.
They let him down, yeah.
Yeah, and Ring Lardner was very much like that too, like when he's watching the game and after he's talked to Eddie, how do you say his last name?
Eddie Seacott.
Yeah, Eddie Seacott. And Eddie tells him, nope, we're not throwing the game. You know, I'm not doing anything. And then you watch his performance and Lardner's sitting going, he lied to me.
You lied to me, Eddie. Yeah.
When you read stuff about Ring Lardner, and Ring Lardner was amazing. If you've never like sat down and read any of his stuff, baseball or otherwise, he was hysterical. He was really, really funny. And people said about his writing that after this game, he never quite approached sports journalism the same again. That he always just saw everything as being kind of on the fix in some way.
Yeah, and I think I remember there was a quote who was brought up in one of the Ken Burns baseball documentaries about him. And it was sort of saying, like, after this, that he just never had much of a passion for baseball anymore, that series just took the love out of it. And he's actually, this guy was involved, but another guy who was also sort of looking at this series and investigating it, and it connects to the World War I a bit, was a guy named Christy Mathewson.
Okay.
And Christy Mathewson is considered one of the greatest pitchers of all time. He played for the New York Giants really, like, turn of the 20th century. And he was originally a manager for the Reds. So he would have actually, at the start of the 1918 or 1919 season, he was a manager. But he served in World War I, and during a training exercise or something, it was during chemical gas, and then inhaled it and messed with his lungs so bad that he had to retire. And actually, after this World Series, he died like 6 years later.
Oh, wow.
But he was also one of the guys that was sort of investigating the World Series, just like the two sports writers are doing.
Yeah.
And it kind of connects to my point. What's so great about this movie, if you studied the thing, is just how much he gets right about it. Just even the smallest things. Like, you can tell Sayles really studied this movie. He didn't try to do a lot of biographies are sort of half-butted, and he does a lot. So, like, one of the scenes with Joe Jackson, like, he creates that character well. Like, even that scene when he's covering looking into the candle.
Yeah.
He actually did that. Like, he did that to prove his eye. He would say, I can hit better with doing that with one eye.
Yeah.
And even this, he had a bat called Black Betsy. He was considered very illiterate. You know, like, there's a lot of people making fun of him because he's a country bumpkin. And I think he got better, I think, as he retired. But yeah, he was illiterate. He did have his wife read the newspapers for him about the game. And it was just that, and just always the little things, like even the say it ain't so, Joe, that really didn't happen, but that's considered like a legend. That started, somebody in the paper reported it, and it just became that happened. Some kid ran up to the courtroom and told him, say it ain't so, Joe.
And then Bernard Malamud takes that, he totally rips that off for the end of the book, The Natural.
Natural.
Doesn't happen in the movie, obviously, because it didn't test well with audiences. They wanted to see Robert Redford win.
Yeah, we could talk about that movie, too.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I hate that movie so much.
Okay. We'll definitely talk about that. Oh, well, that'll be for another show.
Yeah, but going back to something about Ring Lardner is that because he also covered World War I. So, and I was just reading this. There's a book, and it's online, and it's free. Mm-hmm. So you can go on and look. Ring Lardner, 4 weeks in France. And it's about end of July, beginning of August in... And he's been sent over by the Chicago, I think, was it the Examiner that he was working for at the time?
I don't remember.
Okay, one of the two major Chicago papers. I don't think it was the Sun-Times. And he's talking about, going over on the Atlantic, looking out for submarines, getting to France, dealing with trying to get to Paris, dealing with trying to go to the camps to see the French or the British soldiers and the American soldiers. And, like, there's this underlying line about, I wish they would really hurry this up because I've got to get back for the World Series.
Oh, wow.
And my favorite scene of the movie is when they're in a train compartment and they're going along and they're all sitting there talking back and forth. And it's towards the end of the series, and Sayles, as Lardner, walks through the compartment and is singing I'm Forever Blowing Ball Games.
Yeah, yeah, that's
which,
a great scene.
That song, I've always loved that song since I was a kid, so, I'm Forever Blowing Bubbles. And the way he does that and the way you see the expressions on all of the people, whether they're in on the fix or not in on the fix, everybody in that car reacts to the way he does that. I think that's probably the most amazingly staged sequence in that movie because it really captures everything about this notion of draining of hope and this nostalgia and need for integrity. I love that scene.
Yeah, it's a really good scene. And another scene that I'd like to talk about that connects with the historical accuracy, it's when he's talking to Eddie and he gives him the baseball, and this is like, you're not lying to me, are you?
Yeah.
And he gives him the baseball. He's like, wow, this is really tight. It's going to catch on really quick. I'm like, yeah, they're going to bring this in next year. And that's sort of talking about, and once again, baseball history buffs really like this, the dead ball, into the dead ball era and in the beginning of the live ball era, where the dead ball era was that the ball wasn't as tightly wound as that. So basically, you get stronger pitching performances and less power. Mm. That ball was tight winder, you could get more power. And this is when people like Babe Ruth came in. And that time it was the era of the home run. So I liked a little bit about that. But yeah, like you said, that scene's really passionate. And, you know, Sales, it's pretty much this guy's the director and he's also a pretty important player. And he does a great job as an actor, I think, in this movie.
And screenwriter, too. I mean, I looked up his stuff. Almost every single thing, or actually every single thing he ever directed, he was in on the screenplay. Hmm. And the fact that the author of the book was the co-writer of the screenplay and that they did have 11 years to work on this, could really see how things were honed and really just careful attention, like what you're talking about, all these little details. Like, I love during the progress of the movie with Charlie Sheen's character, where he's always doing these kind of basket catches.
Yeah.
So that when he does it in the World Series and he misses, and you're just like, I know he can make that blindfolded.
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, you see, because most of the time in the first couple of games, it doesn't look like he's throwing it. It looks like he's making all these plays.
And then he does that.
And then he does that, and you're just like, oh. But I've been set up to see that because Sales showed me. So I really like that very careful kind of filmmaking where you get set up for these visual cues. So when they pay off bigger.
Exactly. And yeah, and so you talked a little bit about sort of the author of the book, Elliot Azanoff.
Yeah.
You know a bit more about him than I do. I've read his book. I have it. I'm holding it right here in my hands.
He played baseball. He actually was a minor league baseball player. And so that's what, you know, was his undying love and passion. So after that, because he was in the Philadelphia Phillies organization, but he was in the minor leagues.
Okay.
But he would see the thing he really loved was when there would be people from his team that would go up and play in the majors and then get sent back down to the minors. And I guess in baseball, that's just like everybody that's on the team just huddles around you and goes, you know, what was it like? What was it like?
Yeah, yeah.
And so he got so many stories from that. So he's written other fictional and non-fictional books on baseball. He's done other stuff too, but you can really see his passion coming through in the stuff that he writes about baseball, whether it's fictional or non-fictional. He served in World War II in the Army. He was in Adak in the Aleutian Islands, Aleutian Islands being up in Alaska. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure how much action that he saw, but he was blacklisted in the 1950s, and I just thought that was really kind of interesting because he served his country.
Yeah.
It's very patriotic. Usually the kind of people that you see getting blacklisted, you know, or have these obvious kind of communist ties to them. But
he didn't have any?
Well, the thing is, what I wanted to ask you, since you've read the book, and even though people maintain that Sales does such an amazing job of adapting the book in the movie, you know, just looking at it, because for those of you sitting at home, he's got a copy of it that he's holding. And how much of it is in the movie and how much gets left out? And do you get the idea that he's siding mostly with the players because he feels that the players were, I mean, because it comes through in the movie that players seem to be really getting screwed. And this is before they had a union. So I don't know if he's kind of advocating for more players' rights in the same way that we see, like, the way factory workers were getting union rights.
I think he was. Mm-hmm. And now, to be honest, it's been almost 5 years since I've read this book. I've had this for a long time, but it's been 5 years since I've read it. So my memory, I might have lost a few things, but he does kind of go to lengths to tell you how cheap and how, you know, not only how bad he was, but most of the owners in baseball were, which, like, this isn't like a political stance of one way or the other. That happened. They were treated terribly. That's why you had the reserve clause coming in.
Right.
So he just explains, like, something like that happened. Like, that's why they would throw the World Series. Even if it is their biggest professional stage of their career, if you're not getting paid enough and you can make more money throwing a game than, you know, playing your butt off and winning it.
Right.
People looked at that and were saying, "What? You know, why not?"
Right.
And he does, kind of like in the movie too, the character of Swede Risberg, who you saw him along with Chick Gannon, the two guys that were really involved. They seemed like everybody else seemed like they didn't feel somewhat comfortable with it. He said, "We're good with this. Whatever." He was sort of the organizer,
right?
And it's sort of in this movie, he's sort of the guy that keeps everything together, and he even intimidates. Like, you even see in the movies, like, you're not going to do anything stupid, are you, Joe? and he intimidates people. And if you remember during that say it ain't so Joe scene mm-hmm. in the movie, before that, he kind of says, you know, why did you do this? He says, well, Swede's a hard guy. And he actually mm-hmm. said that in real life when he was being questioned. So mm-hmm. basically saying that if anybody was out of line, he was going to do something about it.
Right. But another thing that I thought was really interesting about this, because it does seem to me like if this was such a widely known thing that these games were often on the fix, and what they do spend a lot of time on, not just about the baseball part of this, but they do spend a considerable chunk of time in the movie on the betting aspect of it and mm-hmm. the people that were involved and the fact that, so you've got Swede and who is the other guy?
Chick Gandil, the two main guys.
Yeah, so, and they're like, well, we'll take deals from both sides, and mm-hmm. that means more money, and then you start to see all these bets go south, and all the people, the Christopher Lloyd character, and the mm-hmm. the guy that's kind of the minor flunky for the big guy.
Abatel. Yeah,
and they're all like, you know, we can't put a whole bunch of money down on this, because if they see that I am doing it, they're going to know something's going on, so... You have all this engineering going on about how we're going to make this still look okay, but at the same time, everybody knew, okay, these players are being treated like crap. And also, you're dealing with a whole bunch of people that have these kind of big egos that after everybody knows, you know, you see Charlie Sheen in a bar just drinking beer and basically just telling whoever will listen.
Spilling the beans.
This was doomed to fail.
Yeah, exactly.
And the whole, like, you know, only giving them like $2,000 and then laying it off on all the bets. And you know, obviously this crystallizes very well with the trial that happens at the end where everybody is on the stand and just spilling everything about it. Like, if it's going to help, that it would actually mm-hmm. help them more than harm them to not keep their mouth shut. And how they all got taken for a ride and they all got screwed and... It just seems like this was such a colossal mess up from the get-go that, you know, it's weird that it even came off the way that it did. But I mean, what do you think about that? And it also kind of made me wonder, you know, were Cincinnati in on it?
mean, like... that's a good case. But yeah, it is interesting. But it was probably the money and the backing, like. Mm. Arnold Rothstein, who is the character in this movie, he was also in Boardwalk Empire as a character.
Okay.
He was a very powerful Jewish gangster. Okay. And, you know, he had that money and he had that influence. So you get somebody like that, even if you got a bunch of mid-level gangsters kind of bungling everything up, it'll still probably go if you get the money.
Right.
I think just that promise of money when they said, like, well, this is something I barely make a year. And,
right.
You know, I think it was just that, you know, just like probably a way just to stick it to Kaminsky, just saying, you know, well, you aren't going to pay us. Well, too bad you're not going to get a World Series out of us again.
Right, and it almost seemed too convenient that the bonus that Eddie was supposed to get, which was $10,000 if he had played won those 30 games, mm-hmm. is the exact amount that he's about to get paid off because for throwing this.
Mm-hmm.
And I do really have to hand it to John Mahoney and his character of Kid Gleason and the way that it's so obvious that he knows what's going on. And you still see it ending.
He says it. He keeps hoping that they're
going to write themselves. They're going to write themselves. Around.
And when after they have that great game and last game, he's like, he's bragging to the press, like, we're good now. We got this.
Yeah.
They're back. They got themselves together. And then after the next game, he just realizes it doesn't happen. Yeah. But yeah, I don't know. You know, we're getting close to the end of the questions here, but I do want to talk about how great this cast is, because you admitted that.
Oh, my gosh.
So it's pretty impressive. You got Harold Lloyd right in the middle of Back to the Future fame.
Christopher Lloyd, sorry.
Yeah. Not Harold Lloyd. That's a little bit...
You have to really go back. You'd have to actually be in 1919.
That is 1919. But you got Christopher Lloyd. You got young Charlie Sheen, I think, probably around the same time he was doing, like, Platoon and Wall Street.
When did he do the other baseball movie with Tom Berenger?
Major League?
That Major
was, like,
League.
A year later.
Oh, okay.
You got him. You got John Cusack right in the middle of Say Anything fame.
Yeah.
And then you got like a whole bunch of like good character actors, like John Mahoney. You got who else? Michael Rooker, who's like in is in Guardians of the Galaxy now, so he's still big.
Yeah.
And you just got all these great character actors and just a who's who of 80s.
David Strathairn.
Strathairn.
I never get his name right, but I love him. I don't think I've ever seen him be bad in anything.
He's great.
And you've got D.B. Sweeney playing Shoeless Joe Jackson, and I can remember because I was, you know, a lot back then, watching films in 1987. He really looked like, at the time, he was going to have a really big career, the kinds of movies that he was in. And I don't even know what happened to him. I mean, he's not a bad actor.
I'm familiar with.
Yeah, and he did other sports movies. There was one where he was a hockey player, and he can't play hockey anymore. And so he starts to do ice skating, like couples ice skating. And it's really, really hard for him because he's just like, you know, manly man.
Yeah,
and,
but like it's a
nice little sport. If you're talking about sports movies, I don't remember the title of, but if you look up D.B. Sweeney and you'll see something that's related to hockey, you'll get it. But I just remember seeing him in a couple other things and going, you know, this guy seems pretty good. And then I don't know what happened to him. But yeah, you're right. I mean, the cast is ridiculously good. Even the guy that's in the guy that's hanging out with Christopher Lloyd's character that's in Do the Right Thing.
Oh yeah, Do the Right Thing.
The guy.
Pino. Yeah.
And the guy that you said that plays the big Jewish mobster.
Arnold Rothstein. Yeah, he's a big guy. He was in Barton Fink.
Yeah, I know. I loved him in Barton Fink.
just another one. The guy who plays Sport Sullivan, the Irish guy. That guy's a big character actor too. So just a great like a mix of guys who were big at the time in the 80s, and then just great character actors. I think that's definitely, like you said, even though you felt the plot was too formulaic, you said that cast, though, was really amazing.
I mean, it's still a really interesting movie to watch, and it also makes me think that, boy, look at kind of the way that people respect sales. I mean, it's a movie that was made for $6 million. It didn't even make its money back, but you had all these big names that are working in this movie, and this movie is not a big budget movie. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's on something that, you know, maybe not everybody was going to go and see. Maybe they kind of knew from the get-go it's just about getting it right, not about making big bucks.
Yeah.
Which, you know, independent filmmakers, that's how they think. But, I mean, look at the faith all these guys had that just wanted to go out there and tell the story. That's impressive. To me, that's impressive. I would... Mm-hmm. It's kind of almost the way Coen Brothers films used to be. Now they've got enough pull and enough stuff that, you know, to back movies where you can get Scarlett Johansson and
Jonah Hill.
Yeah,
and
exactly. To show up for 2 minutes and do something. Yeah, they'll do that now. But look at sales, you know, in 1988 that he can pull in this kind of cast for basically peanuts. That's very cool.
Yeah, and so I guess we talk a little bit about sales career. I'll be completely honest, this is the only movie of his I've seen.
Mm-hmm.
I know another movie of his that gets really rave reviews is Lone Star. Have you seen that?
No, I actually, when I was going through his filmography, I've seen like maybe one or two other things. What I thought was interesting about him, this is saying something, is that he got his start writing scripts for Roger Corman.
It seems like everybody does that.
There you go. I mean, nothing will give you a foundation like that.
Yeah, Scorsese, everybody does that now.
Yeah, Francis Ford Coppola. But it's kind of sad because, you know, you have somebody that definitely has talent, and I guess the only film that he ever made outside the studio system was Baby, It's You in 1983. They didn't give him final cut, and he pretty much disowns it. Everything else he's ever done, he's had final cut on. That's ridiculous.
Give the credit to the man. The man
and
wants
post New Hollywood, for that to happen is crazy.
Yeah, and I think that's what I kind of always get bummed out, like connecting it to the modern cinema now. You have this big wave of anytime like a indie director person makes like a really hit indie film.
Yeah.
Studios say, we want this guy to direct the next King Kong movie or Spider-Man movie or whatever.
Right.
And I think, I wish those guys, like we talked a little bit earlier about Get Out, he's just been a tap to do a remake of Akira.
I saw that.
And I'm just like,
whoa, I don't know about that fit. I mean, I know he's good, but
once again, he's doing a studio film, a remake. Not to go on about Get Out, but I'd like to see Jordan Peele stick to horror comedies and stick to horror films and kind of add some sort of social commentary. That's a lot better than doing a remake.
Or do something that he wants to do. Let him go ahead and explore.
Yeah,
give him the budget that he needs to have.
Just wish these guys, like, that. Sometimes you just got to avoid being seduced by the big budget and the big Hollywood studios.
But we sit here saying that.
Yeah, we sit here saying that.
Because nobody's handing us millions of dollars. Like, say it ain't so, Peel. But no, it's got to be hard. It's a hard dance.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of times when you're in a business where, say, you're a minor league baseball player and you see what it might be like to take a taste of the big stuff, or you are... a filmmaker that can't that takes 11 years to get a movie made. Somebody dangle something in front of you. It would probably be impossible to turn that down. Okay. I worry about Akira. I mean, have you seen all the stuff coming out about Ghost in the Shell?
To be honest, I need to watch the original Ghost in the Shell first. I haven't even seen that, so I got to watch that first before I even get into this new stuff. But
no,
okay.
I mean, if what you can read in the press is saying I haven't heard or seen one positive thing, and the anime is great. I'll bring it in for you next time I see you.
We'll have to. We could do a show on that because I need to watch that.
If you ever want to start getting into anime,
we can definitely do that.
Akira. We can do all that.
We'll talk about that. So I guess one of the last things we like to talk about is just tell us about maybe once again, you're not the hugest. You kind of like baseball, but you're not a big diehard. So, but talk about any other baseball movies. I know you say you have this intense hatred of The Natural.
Yeah, well, I have a love hate relationship with it because I read the book when I was a kid. I was in middle school. And because it was
right
when
the big ending,
movie came
he strikes out.
Yeah. And we read it actually for school, which kind of blows my mind because there's sex in it and stuff. And I was pretty young. It wasn't even high school then. I don't remember what year Natural came out, but I want to say about maybe 84. 85. Yeah. So I was 11. So that's a weird thing to give to an 11-year-old. But I saw the film and I read the book and I was like, how is it possible that you could have two different things like that? I just didn't. I mean, that's really kind of what fueled my initial love for film adaptations, because it boggled my mind that you could have this source material and they lose, and this film and they win, and it's just Hollywood to the nth degree with the sparks that are flying out of the lights that have been
I'll tell you what, maybe for MLB All-Star Break or July 4th, we could do The Natural, because I totally get where you're coming from, but I really like that movie.
Oh, I like the movie too, and except for Glenn Close, because that was also I think something that I saw after I saw Fatal Attraction. Well, I must have not have been 11. My parents would have never let me see that. But Glenn Close just scares the hell out of me because of Fatal Attraction. So you put her in this nice motherly role, I'm like, no, she's still going to eat your rabbit. So.
Yeah. And in other movies, just to kind of rattle off a few, Field of Dreams is a classic.
Oh, yeah. And it's got Shoeless Joe Jackson in it. Yep. Ray Liotta.
Yeah. What other ones? The Ken Burns baseball documentary is a must watch.
Okay.
What other ones?
How does he treat the steroids era? Does he do it?
He didn't do it in that one because that ended in 94. But in 2010, he talks about it a lot.
Okay.
And one baseball movie, which I don't like now, I think is really bad, is called Cobb. It's about Ty Cobb.
Okay.
It's with Tommy Lee Jones. He plays Ty Cobb.
Oh.
And basically, it's based off this supposed biography written by a guy named Al Stump, who spent like a week or so with Ty Cobb to write his biography. And it was the last year or so before his death. And basically, which has now been permeated through pop culture, anybody who knows anything about Ty Cobb, was that Ty Cobb was a horrible, racist, just unlikable in any way.
Oh, wow.
And even in the movie, he attempts to rape a young woman, but he can't do it only because he's tired and impotent.
Oh.
The movie paints him horrible, and that's sort of been even the Ty Cobb and the baseball movie in the Ken Burns' baseball. They say he's done this. He beat up a black person.
Oh.
I just read a recent biography that completely changed my mind about him. It was called A Terrible Beauty, Ty Cobb. It's by Charles Learson. If you ever get a chance, read it.
Okay.
Al Stump was a fraud. He was, even at that time, he was kicked out of nearly every newspaper publication he was in because he was making up stories.
Okay.
He even points out that nearly every claim he makes about Ty Cobb in that biography and that supposed weekend he spent with him has no citations, no sources, and it's pretty much all crap, which I feel is so bad because everybody now, even if you talk, ask any baseball guy about Ty Cobb, great player, horrible human being.
Right.
And I just read that, reading that book, he doesn't get off the hook. That he had a terrible temper. Mm-hmm. And he would fight anybody in baseball.
Okay.
But I'll be honest, I'm not going to paint him as
he's not a Boy Scout.
Yeah. And he wouldn't be necessarily politically correct with his racial opinions. I mean, let's be honest, he grew up in turn of the century Georgia. I mean,
cool.
So, but he talks about how he's nowhere near the racist he's portrayed. His grandfather, I believe, was on the Underground Railroad.
Oh.
His father was a senator in Georgia, and his father, while he wasn't fighting segregation, he did say, we're not giving a lot of funding to African-American schools. We need to give them more money. Mm-hmm. So that should be considered. He had a personal Bat Boy who was an African-American for 6 years, and they reportedly were very good friends. And actually, the Bat Guy named one of his kids Tyrus.
Oh, wow.
After that. Jackie Robinson integration, he said he full-heartedly supported the integration of baseball without any reservations. And Ty Cobb in his later years was kind of your prototypical, back in my day, we played things better.
Right.
But he actually, one exception, he said in the 50s, like, I don't like any of the players now, but one guy I do like is Willie Mays. I pay to go see that guy play. So I think there's enough there to just say that this guy wasn't the monster he was supposedly. He was unfairly tainted by a guy who's a notable fraud. And I like to see somebody do like either a mini series or some kind of, to do him more justice, just to say that this guy got the bad end of the stick and to see a bit more change.
Or like something like a series where you have like an episode at one point where you have like these personalities from sports and you start to go back and maybe do more research and say like, were they really like this? Were they really like that?
We should be
in charge of a production company, because I think that would be really interesting.
Maybe this is the screenwriter inside me, but something like a Citizen Kane approach to who Ty Cobb really was.
Huh.
And because actually I read that book, and immediately at the library I picked up another book written by his grandson. Basically talked about how Ty Cobb's son, which was that guy's dad, was abusive and alcoholic, but basically during every like month or so in the summer, he would go visit his grandfather. And basically, it's this very touching story. They had a lot of heart-to-heart conversations. Cobb said, you know, maybe I would have done a lot of things differently in my life, and I regretted a lot of the things I did. But, you know, he says, I feel bad that I wasn't necessarily there for my kids all the time. And I just think, so this guy has been so, I think, wronged by the press.
Yeah.
I think people still view him as this horrible racist man when there's a lot more to the guy, and I don't think he was the monster it portrays him to be. I know I've ranted a lot about this, and I apologize.
But I think that actually points out something that's important about today's movie, like this idea that our only narrative about the Black Sox of 1919 is based on this one book and this one film. And if you go to like Wikipedia, it's basically a blow by blow of what you see in the film. Mm-hmm. And the film is a blow by blow of the book. And then you start to see these other things coming out from like the Shoeless Joe Jackson Museum and this Chicago Law Review. So there's a real inherent danger of there being one voice that is the voice. Mm-hmm. Because if that voice is wrong, history marching forward is going to think of it that way.
Yeah, and going a little bit more, but one of the things they paint him like, why do you, you know, why people say, you're defending this guy? This guy killed three people. He didn't kill anybody. This whole stretch because he got into a fight with a night watchman. Everybody said this guy was black. No, the guy was white. And we don't really know what happened, but Ty Cobb might have been drunk and they got into a little bit of a scuffle, but that basically was it. But basically the stretch that he beat him to death, then he took on these other two African-American guys who were trying to help him, and he killed them, but he paid off the cops or something to get away with it, and that none of that happened.
That's crazy.
And just connect a little bit to the Shoeless Joe. One of the things in Field of Dreams I roll my eyes out now is when everybody, you know, it's Field of Dreams, it's everybody's there at the ballpark, all the spirits are there. And then Shoeless Joe says, Ty Cobb wanted to play with us, but we couldn't stand the SOB when he was alive. If you know anything, Shoeless Joe Jackson and Ty Cobb were very good friends.
Oh.
And actually, there's a story of after the Black Sox scandal, Shoeless Joe's running a like convenience store or something. He owns it. And he runs into Ty Cobb. And they don't necessarily say anything after a little while.
Yeah.
And then Ty Cobb says, what's the matter, Joe? Don't you recognize me? And he's like, sure, I recognize you, Ty, but I don't think anyone wanted to recognize me in baseball anymore.
Yeah.
So like they're
it's sad.
Yeah.
You're right. I mean it's a problem. And in this culture, especially in this day and age where people are very unwilling to actually read and research, and it's a lot easier to show someone a 2-hour movie than to do like hours and hours of reading.
Mm-hmm.
So much of history is being gleaned off historical movies, and I think that's incredibly dangerous.
Exactly.
Because it's not going to show you the whole picture. Anybody that's even the closest as they possibly could be to historical accuracy in a movie is still going to play up certain things in order for you to not put the audience asleep, because real time doesn't happen the same way as movie time.
Yeah.
So I think it's important to guard against that and to not just be so accepting of this is the actual truth.
Mm-hmm. So, for a little bit of reading material for you listeners out there, first read Eight Men Out by Elliot Asimov. That's a really good read about the scandal. And if you're interested in anything about what I've been talking about, Ty Cobb, read A Terrible Beauty by Charles Learson. And I can't remember the name of, like, My Life with the Tiger or something. Heart of a Tiger, I believe, is the book by Ty Cobb's grandson. So read those if you want to.
And read Ring Lardner's 4 Weeks in France, because that
definitely.
Was that he is very, very funny, and it's also a really interesting picture of the end of World War One.
Okay, then. So we're going to
read a lot. Stop watching these movies.
Yeah, don't read a book every now and then. Okay, then. So this wraps up our episode of The Armchair Directors. You did a great job as a host.
Thank you.
It was really good.
You did an awesome job.
Yes.
With your tiger shirt on.
Yes.
For the audience at home, he's wearing a tiger shirt.
Yes, just in case you didn't know I was a Tigers fan without talking about Ty Cobb so much. But so anyway, for The Armchair Directors, you can listen to The Armchair Directors every Thursday at 9:30 a.m., Sunday at 2:30 p.m., or anytime at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com under the category Armchair Directors. I want to thank you again for coming on the show today.
Absolutely.
So for the Armchair Directors, I'm your host, Alex Baker, saying 29 is not 30, Eddie.